From NPR and WBUR, I'm Tanya Mosley.
I'm Peter O'Dowd. This is Here and Now. Later today, the state of Pennsylvania is expected to certify its results from the presidential election. The Trump campaign is still pursuing one more legal challenge in that state after a federal judge on Saturday rejected its request to throw out some mail-in ballots. But it is a different state in the Midwest that's in the spotlight today.
Michigan is also expected to certify its vote, but two Republicans on an obscure elections board may vote against certification, and there are a lot of questions about what happens next. Joining us now is Michigan Public Radio's chief political correspondent, Rick Pluta. And Rick, certification is in the hands of the Board of State Canvassers, two Democrats, two Republicans. Who are these Republicans, and what have they said about how they'll vote this afternoon?
Well, one of them is Aaron Van Langeveld, and he is an attorney for our State House Republican caucus. And the other one, and he's the one who's really getting the attention, is Norman Schenkel. He's a former legislator, an elected official, and he's kind of the dean of the board. He's been on it for decades, and he's kind of, well, more than hinted that he may vote not to certify based on questions that Republicans are pushing surrounding the voting in Wayne County and Detroit. And so kind of all eyes are on Norm Schenkel.
Right, right. Well, two Michigan state lawmakers who met at the White House with President Trump on Friday have said they want the board to follow the legal process. It's not supposed to be a discretionary process, is it?
Yeah, it's not. The way it was set up, two Republicans, two Democrats, it's supposed to make sure that both sides are keeping an eye on each other. But the job is to basically make sure that the boxes are checked, that everyone shows up with the right paperwork. It's not a fact-finding body. It's not an investigatory body. It doesn't have the power to demand investigations. It doesn't have subpoena power, for example. So it's administrative.
Yeah. Well, what happens if the board is deadlocked? Does it then go to the courts?
Typically, and this has happened more often with ballot questions than you know, these candidate elections. But yeah, sometimes it does go to court with one side demanding that the board fulfill its administrative responsibilities to certify the votes based on the votes as they've been counted by local elected officials. It's just kind of the final step in certifying the process.
Yeah. Well, Rick, you've been in the thick of coverage. There are a lot of questions being asked about the Board of State Canvassers. Like, can the governor remove a canvasser? Why is this process so broken in Michigan? Why even have this board?
Mm-hmm. Well, there is, it does appear that the governor can remove a canvasser for not fulfilling their legal responsibilities. But then there's also this question of how quickly can a canvasser be replaced? Because obviously we're dealing with some time issues here. And what's happened is this is a bipartisan process. It's evenly divided, but it works only as long as both teams are playing by the same rules, the same understandings of what this board is supposed to be doing. And now it's moved into uncharted territory of, you know, things like demanding investigations.
Yeah. Okay, so after today's vote, an audit of the vote is supposed to take place. Does that have the power to change anything?
I guess theoretically, although the audit is typically post-election, you know, on process issues. But Joe Biden won by 154,000 votes. We also have a U.S. Senate seat in play, but that was also a decisive vote. So, no, not really. I mean, you're not going to change enough votes to change the result here in Michigan. You could just drag it out.
Yeah, well, we'll be watching today. That's Rick Pluta is Michigan Public Radio's chief political correspondent. Thank you so much for this.
Thank you.
Well, with a week still to go in November, the United States has already seen 3 million new people infected with the coronavirus. It's a quarter of the country's total cases recorded in just 21 days. The surge is straining hospitals. At the world-renowned Mayo Clinic, there's news that more than 900 workers have tested positive for COVID-19 over a two-week period in November. Dr. Laura Breer is an occupational health specialist at the Mayo Clinic in Rochester, Minnesota. Dr. Breer, welcome. And tell us first about these numbers, which must have been as alarming to you as it was to everybody else.
So we've been tracking this since the onset of the pandemic, and in some ways it was surprising, in others it wasn't, because we know that there is a surge across the Midwest happening. So it was not especially surprising when our employees started testing positive from those exposures that they're having in their household and community.
Well, maybe you saw it coming, but 900, the number itself is large. Were those employees at different Mayo campuses across the Midwest?
Yes, it is a large number of healthcare workers, and I can appreciate that that stood out to many people. But we also have many, many healthcare workers across our Midwest campuses. So we have 68,000 staff across the U.S., as well as 55,000 across the Midwest alone. And those numbers include not just healthcare workers that are working in our hospitals and clinics, but also healthcare workers that are telecommuting.
That is good context. Dr. Amy Williams, Dean of Clinical Practice at Mayo, said that 93% of the infected staff did not catch the virus at work. How do you know that?
So we interview every person that tests positive for COVID, staff members, as well as students, volunteers, contractors, to determine if they had an exposure to someone with COVID-19, as well as if they had any exposure to a patient, if they had any breach in PPE. And so we've been very carefully assessing that since the onset of the pandemic. So I looked this morning, and less than 5% of infections right now were from a confirmed exposure within our campuses. And that's because the vast majority of those happened early on, before we knew a lot about this, before universal masking. So the recent infections, the vast, vast majority of those are happening in the community and households.
Well, what does that suggest to you? Does it say that people are letting their guard down once they get outside the hospital?
There are some situations where people will go to a public setting and we can control our own mask use, but where we can't be confident that other people will be wearing their masks, that becomes a risk for transmission to us. The other things that we've been seeing are an increase in household transmissions. Recently, in the past month, just under 30%, 27% of our known positive infections are from a confirmed household exposure. That can happen because college students are coming home and they've been exposed on campus and subsequently develop COVID, or children participating in sports events or things like that. This is so widespread now that it's not just being transmitted from people taking risks. It's also being transmitted because it's infiltrating our households. And once it gets into a household, it's kind of hard to escape it. So I think that's why it's very, very important that we all practice precautions and assume every single person we encounter might have COVID.
So throughout the course of this pandemic, we've been talking about a shortage of hospital beds, a shortage of ventilators and protective equipment. Now that the virus really starts to be taking off this fall and into the winter, we're talking about a shortage of hospital staff here. So what does all of this mean for the level of care inside your hospitals to have that many people infected?
So when we look across our Midwest practice, today, we have 1,700 employees that are either out due to COVID infection or have restrictions due to exposure. So that's impacting our staffing. What we found recently is, especially since these exposures are happening in the household and the community, it's unpredictable where those infections will happen. I know that right now, we are doing many things to ensure adequate staffing, including some of our colleagues from our Arizona and Florida practices coming to the Midwest to help staff our hospitals. Our doors are open right now. It's very safe to come get care, but I think that it's also very important that we all come together right now and start practicing those precautions so that the situation doesn't get worse. We know that masking works, social distancing works, and so we can't give up on those precautions just due to a vaccine on the horizon. Even once vaccines are available, it will take months and months to vaccinate the U.S. population.
That's Dr. Laura Breer, an occupational health specialist at the Mayo Clinic in Rochester, Minnesota. Doctor, thank you. Stay safe. We appreciate your time.
Thank you.
And here's an update from the United Kingdom on the pandemic and restrictions there. British Prime Minister Boris Johnson says shops, hairdressers, beauty salons, and gyms in England will reopen. Some fans will be allowed back into sports stadiums when a four-week lockdown comes to an end next week. Johnson confirmed to lawmakers today that the government will lift the stay-at-home order on December 2nd. And an update here in the United States. Last week, I was reporting on the precautions that farmers were taking in Yuma County, Arizona, as the busy lettuce harvest gets underway. Well, the positivity rate in Yuma County is now up to 22%. We're going to keep tracking that story and the pandemic as it progresses and rages across the U.S. and the globe.
Millions of students at colleges and universities across the country are preparing for Thanksgiving break, a time when most of them would usually leave campus. But this year, the annual student exodus has been stalled by the surging pandemic, and schools are taking extra precautions to stop the spread of the coronavirus. At the State University of New York system, known as SUNY, all students will be required to provide proof of negative test results before they're allowed to leave. Jim Malatris is SUNY's chancellor, and he joins us now for more from Albany, New York. Welcome.
Oh, thank you for having me on.
So normally, SUNY has about 400,000 full-time students across 64 campuses, but now during the fall semester, only about 140,000 were actually there. How many of them have been tested so far?
So we've been testing now for about 2 weeks as we wind down our in-person classes for the remainder of the semester. And to date, we've tested 149,000 students and faculty. So we're virtually there of testing everyone. We have today and tomorrow. We end at tomorrow at noon, but we're basically there already. It's been a tough, arduous task, a giant operational undertaking and challenge,
yeah.
But our campuses have done quite well.
Tell us more about that. I know that New York Governor Andrew Cuomo and six other governors in the Northeast are urging colleges to provide free testing. How did you all undergo this? Did you provide testing or paying for these tests? Or are students making their own arrangements?
So this was something that was really important to us. So about a month and a half ago, most health experts told us to basically send people home during Thanksgiving and then transition to remote learning. So like we set up the system to be that way.
Mm.
Let's take an extra precaution. Let's mandate that we test all of our students on the way out. So while most systems or colleges and universities are offering the testing, we actually made it a requirement for students before they left. But they're used to it. We required at the beginning of the semester that every one of our 64 campuses test regularly, our students, our faculty, and our staff. So that's why I think we've had a smoother time at this. We do it for free. We don't charge students, faculty, or staff for it. And we're able to produce it an in-campus test. We can do about 200,000 tests a week. So, and we took the cost on ourselves, so no one has to pay out of pocket for it.
Students are used to this, as you said, over this past semester, and they're used to this requirement. But how are you enforcing it?
So, you know, the good thing is there's been so much cynicism about students all across the nation, and you know, sometimes it's warranted. You've seen outbreaks arise because of large parties and students not conforming to the social distance guidelines. We had a couple of examples ourselves at the State University of New York system, but overwhelming majority of our students have complied with the social distancing and the masks and not doing large gatherings. So I think our students have been really mindful of doing tests because they don't want to bring the virus home and infect their loved ones, right? They're going to go home and see their parents. They're going to see their grandparents. They're going to see their immune compromised brothers and sisters. They don't want to bring it home. So the students I've been talking to and the students all across the system that I hear from are like, thank you. We want to make sure that we're not bringing this invisible killer home potentially with us. But for those small number of students that don't comply with the mandatory testing, we have pretty strict rules in place. One of the things that we did when I became chancellor at the end of August for the State University of New York was we put in uniform compliance policies, which means if you violate the COVID protocols on your campus, if you don't do mandatory testing and those types of things, you could be suspended or even expelled from college. There's serious consequences because this is a serious national health crisis. But we've had to use that very sparingly. Mostly our students have been complying because they want to do the right thing.
Mm-hmm. I hear exactly what you're saying, but can we do the what if for a moment? If students test positive and they don't have a safe option to isolate, for instance, you've actually said you're keeping campuses open. How is that working? Is SUNY providing and paying for housing and medical care for these students who can't leave if they test positive? And for how long?
In New York State, like most states, if you test positive for COVID, it's a 14-day isolation or quarantine period. We have a moral responsibility to our students as well, right? Some students have the ability to work with their local health department and find a space at home. But for many of our students who are living through this deeply troubling time health-wise, but also economically, right? They're like living on the edge with housing insecurity and food insecurity. Mm-hmm. We thought it was really important to mandate that our campuses remain open for those students who need housing, who need meals, who need medical support, which they are doing. And this is a moving target, right? Right now, we have about 900 students who have tested positive all across mm-hmm. our system, right? That number changes day to day, depending on who comes in and who comes out. About 87% of those students right now are isolating or quarantining on our campuses or in an apartment right off campus and things like that, where the services are being provided by the campus. We have a deep responsibility and commitment to our students, and we don't want to change that now, given a health crisis, given that they may not have a place to go, and given that's around the holidays too, and it's really tough on many of our students and their families. So we wanted to take extra care for them.
You mentioned how this has been really hard on students and families. And I hear that SUNY has said it's expanding its mental health services for students. What have you heard from students so far about how they're doing through all of this?
This has been a really difficult time for our students. I think our students were happy to be back. And we were one of the few large university systems in the country to bring students back, like you mentioned. But, you know, the issues of loneliness and isolation and living in this different time where you have to be social distance as a matter of public health has taken a toll on our students. This is a really tough time, not only for everyone in society, right? I mean, everybody's feeling this COVID fatigue, but at the same time, especially our students, because they're living in a different environment, they're away from their families, and it's really tough and challenging for them.
Yeah. This is also a really expensive undertaking, I can imagine. How much is SUNY spending to cover all of these extra costs?
Well, the testing has cost several million dollars probably for all of our campuses. Mental health service expansion has probably cost several million dollars as well. These are difficult budget times for everyone across our communities, especially in states that need desperate federal aid, which we hope we get soon. But in a way, we don't really have a choice. So you always find ways in these difficult times to prioritize funding where they need to be prioritized for. So we're cutting back in other areas where we don't need to spend, so we can spend on those areas that need spending the most.
Last month, SUNY Oneonta announced the resignation of its president after more than, I think, about 700 students tested positive there. Other campuses have reported just a handful of cases. What precautions have you taken on campus to prevent new infections? I understand the continual testing that's happening, but how are you coordinating these plans across the dozens of campuses throughout the state?
So one of the things I wanted to bring to bear as chancellor was more uniformity across our 64 campuses. We put in place uniform testing rules, so every campus had to test. We put more uniform compliance rules in place, so it was being evenly applied, so there were serious consequences for violating public health orders by our students and others. We put in a transparency program, so you can actually go to a dashboard and see what's going on in individual campuses, so people have the right to know, our parents, our faculty, our students. And then we put in more uniform social distancing rules, mandatory masks at all times, limiting density and things like that. All of those things together has worked. But really what it's come down to is reinforcing this is a public health crisis. Oneonta was a giant wake-up call for our system. When I got that call, there were two cases of COVID on campus. 2 weeks later, there were 700 cases. I think that was a way for people to say, wait a minute, this spreads really quickly. This hasn't gone yet. Let's take extra care. And our students have done that.
Chancellor, we're all learning as we're going. I mean, this pandemic has really forced us to act really fast. And looking back at this fall semester, do you have any regrets staying open maybe as long as you have, or any other steps that you make? And as you look to the spring semester, what are you thinking about as ways to do things differently?
What I think we've all found during this crisis as people are learning more and more, right?
Yeah.
I think you have to be flexible and adaptable. And we're a giant system. We're like a giant ocean liner. It's really hard for an ocean liner to turn in the ocean, but we've had to do that pretty quickly in order to adapt. And that really does show that you can address these issues in a meaningful way. You can adapt. Once we heard Dr. Fauci and others saying that Thanksgiving travel will be problematic, we adapted. We said, let's exit test all of our students as a mandate. When we heard that you needed more social distancing rules and mask wearing, we complied. And we said, let's do mandatory masks at all times. So I think constant adaptability is that. And you're seeing that from us as well going into the spring. We know that the cold and the winter months are something that are a concern to our public health experts. So we're starting our semester later in the semester. Instead of starting in January, we're going to start in February. But if they come back to us a month from now and say, wait a minute, there's too many cases going on in your state, take a little more time, we'll take a little more time. We've had to unfortunately cancel spring break for this spring because we don't want our students traveling across the country and going to different places. They call me Chancellor No Fun, which I feel sad for sometimes because I'm a lot of fun, Tanya. But in the end, you adapted. So instead of doing a spring break, we're doing mental health and wellness days throughout the course of the semester. We have to balance access to quality education in a time where you need more education now than ever with public safety and public health. And I think we've been able to balance that on the whole quite well. And that always goes back to the students. It's not what I say, it's what they do.
That's Jim Mylatris, Chancellor of the State University of New York System. Thank you so much for taking the time.
Thank you.
Support for Here and Now and the following message is brought to you by the New England Innovation Academy, an innovative engine for students in grades 6 through 12, the first middle and high school that prepares innovators to shape the world through human-centered design. Part world school, part incubator, teaching the cultural dexterity and global focus this era demands. To learn more, visit neiacademy.org.
A recent poll by the American Psychiatric Association shows that nearly two-thirds of Americans feel more anxious than they did this time last year. The pandemic has heightened mental health problems nationwide, and some experts say this has led to an increase in drug overdoses. Side Effects Public Media's Darian Benson reports.
With a surge in COVID-19 cases, Illinois officials are urging people to stay home. And other Midwest states, such as Indiana and Iowa, are adding restrictions to limit gatherings. That worries Brandon George, director of the Indiana Addictions Issues Coalition. He says restrictions might shut down recovery meetings for Narcotics Anonymous and other groups, just like they did in the spring.
We were lucky that with the seasonal timing of the first round of shutdowns, a lot of the meetings, a lot of meeting with other people and getting that community connection, we were able to improvise and do that outside.
In winter, meeting outside might not be an option. And for people with substance use disorder, George says isolation can be deadly.
We're finding less and less safe ways to be able to interact with folks. And addiction is deadly. Alcoholism is deadly. For some people, that might be the most deadliest piece healthcare-wise for them.
Closing down businesses and issuing stay-at-home orders helped combat COVID-19. But George says that might have done more harm than good for those with substance use disorder.
The solution for one pandemic was the opposite of the solution for the overdose crisis / epidemic that we're having.
Overdose rates are increasing nationwide. In Indiana, where overdoses started to go down in 2019, emergency departments are seeing a more than 80% rise this year. And overdose deaths increased more than 30% between January and May. The pandemic has made a lot of problems worse, including depression and anxiety. And that means more people might be turning to drugs and alcohol.
The technical term is called comorbidity, and comorbidity means patients have more than one condition, two conditions.
That's Kurt Kronke, a researcher with the Reconstrief Institute in Indianapolis. He says this is common in people with substance use disorder.
They're at much greater risk of also suffering from depression. Probably a third to half or more also have depression as well as their problem with opiates.
Kevin Farron used drugs to cope with mental health problems. He's 23 and lives in Fishers, a suburb just north of Indianapolis.
It's kind of like a scapegoat from anything, like whether it's anxiety, anger, anything you're going through. When you do it, you just feel completely numb.
He says he got clean this year.
In May was the first time I was able to deal with my life like a normal human being would. You know, actually being able to like deal with my anxiety, get a job and be a functioning member in society.
But the pandemic has made it more of a struggle, and he still gets the urges that led him to drugs. The Regenstief Institute's Kurt Kronke is working on a study that helps treat depression and opioid use disorder simultaneously.
So, I mean, you can imagine a person who has problems with opiates and depressed, it's going to be more difficult for them to participate in treatment for their problem with opiates.
Meanwhile, Brandon George and the Indiana Addictions Issues Coalition are preparing for the state legislators' next session in January.
COVID's not going anywhere. The overdose crisis isn't going anywhere. And we got to really make sure that we stay focused on both of those things.
The coalition is pushing for more telehealth flexibility and an extension for the state's syringe exchange program. Those resources can help the recovery community even after the pandemic ends. For Here and Now, I'm Darian Benson in Indianapolis.
A new form of ultra-high-speed travel is moving a step closer to reality. Earlier this month, human passengers rode in a Hyperloop train for the first time ever. The Virgin Hyperloop test run was on a 500-meter track north of Las Vegas. The passenger pod traveled inside an enclosed tube at more than 100 miles per hour, though it could have reached much greater speeds. Here's how the video channel B1M describes the technology.
Hyperloop was first conceived in 2012. By Tesla and SpaceX founder Elon Musk. In a white paper released the following year, Musk set out his vision for a futuristic, super high-speed transportation system that would see passenger pods move through a partial vacuum in steel tubes, addressing the two key factors that slow down conventional vehicles: friction and air resistance.
Virgin Hyperloop is one of a handful of companies that's currently trying to build a system for passenger travel. And Sara Lukian is the company's director of passenger experience. She was also one of the two people on board the test ride. Sara, welcome to Here and Now. I'm excited to hear how this test went. What was it like to travel inside a Hyperloop?
It was exhilarating. I mean, it was such a thrill, largely because of the psychology of the moment, just understanding the magnitude of what we were accomplishing. But of course, it was a sporty ride that was quite thrilling physically as well.
How long did it take?
The whole ride was only 15 seconds from start to finish, but probably the most memorable 15 seconds of my life.
Okay, so let's just back up a little bit. You were in this pod inside a vacuum tube, and I'm sorry if that's not the technical term there, but just take a minute to explain how it worked. Like, what's the technology behind this system?
Yeah, absolutely. So with the Hyperloop, our vehicles, which we call pods, accelerate gradually via electric propulsion inside of this low pressure tube. It's not a perfect vacuum, but it's very close. And so the pod actually glides along using the magnetic levitation. It can reach very high speeds because there's no friction of vehicle against track and there's ultra low aerodynamic drag. So what I experienced was basically maglev within a vacuum. As you noted, we got up to about 107 miles per hour in just 6 seconds.
And did you not go as fast just because your track was only 500 meters long?
Yeah, that's exactly right. We are constrained by the length of the tube. So if we were to go up to our intended speeds of over 600 miles per hour, of course, the acceleration would be very fast. And that would subject the human passengers to G-forces that, wouldn't be very comfortable.
No. Did you feel any G-forces at 100 miles per hour?
I felt the acceleration a little bit. It was maybe two or three times as strong as what you feel when you're taking off in a plane. But certainly not uncomfortable.
But if you went six times faster than that, how do you make it so that it's not six times as uncomfortable? Or could you?
Oh, we absolutely could. And one of the advantages of the Hyperloop is that we have control over the environment. So we would just accelerate at a slower rate. And when you have more length of tube, you can do it over a greater distance. So our intention is for the acceleration to be about 0.2 Gs, which is very similar to what we have in conventional trains today. You'd barely feel it.
What's the significance of pulling this test off, and how much closer does it get you to fulfilling whatever dream it is that you're reaching for with the Hyperloop?
This is a major milestone for us for a couple of reasons. First, the most important thing about the Hyperloop is that it absolutely has to be safe. And we demonstrated that safety with two passengers and then another two the next day in this system. I also think it's a major milestone because it demonstrates the dedication of a group of people who are able to get together and make this happen despite the difficulty of this year and overcoming the obstacles of COVID and other things. I think it's really a testament to the team and their passion for a cleaner and more connected future.
But there's still a lot of hurdles to clear before you can get to a point where you're moving passengers and cargo at any significant scale. The technology is something you're still working on. The infrastructure, building that would be a major undertaking. Acquiring land to build it on would also be a big deal. What problem are you most focused on right now trying to solve?
There is a lot of work still to do, of course, as you note. But this is a step towards certification, right? So we have recently announced our Hyperloop Certification Center in the state of West Virginia, and that is going to move us even closer to having independent safety assessors, regulators evaluate the system and ensure that it is safe for passengers at commercial scale. So, of course, we need the collaboration of government and, you know, everything else that you noted. Those are all obstacles, but they're absolutely surmountable. And we have a lot of momentum now.
I'm just thinking about how hard it is to build a high-speed rail project in the United States, though. So, I mean, what makes you think that building a Hyperloop would be any easier?
Well, I think that it's not high-speed rail, right? This is the first new mode of transportation in over a century. You know, I think one of the issues with existing modes is that they have legacy problems from the 20th century, whether it's rail, subway, air, and we are building for a 21st century solution. In some regions of the world, we're essentially leapfrogging the technology of the last several decades. Our value proposition is different. We're moving at such high speeds that we can effectively connect cities like metro stops. You know, it's on demand, it's direct to destination. We can really transform economies in the way that people live.
So what is the dream? What cities do you want to connect?
Well, you know, I think if there's one thing we've learned from this year is that no one has a crystal ball. It's really hard to know which place will land first. I'm personally biased because I live in Los Angeles. And heck, I would take a route just from downtown to Santa Monica would be a huge time savings. But the thing that is really remarkable to me is that we have had so much enthusiasm from people around the world. Everyone seems to see the use case for them and their community in their region.
I'm just thinking, so LA to Santa Monica would be a very quick trip. What about something like LA to San Francisco? You're talking about a distance of several hundred miles that would take you, what, like 20-something minutes?
Yeah, maybe half an hour or so. That's exactly right. I mean, I think everyone can see how their lives might be transformed if they were able to connect major cities to one another, but also have access to those cities, maybe from more rural or suburban regions. It would really transform where we could live, access to affordable housing, but also to good jobs, which are increasingly in city centers. So I of course, would love to see my friends in San Francisco. I'd love a cross-continental route. I think the real power of the Hyperloop is demonstrated when it is a network and not just an A to B route. But of course, that will be some years ahead.
Thinking about what this future would look like, the idea of a failure or a collision going at those speeds is something that, you know, everyone, before they step on board this type of system, is going to think about. You're one of like the only people on Earth who've ever actually done it. Were you scared at all when you got on board?
I actually was not scared at all. I was excited. I think if I had any nerves, it was more about not wanting to say something stupid in front of the cameras afterward. But I have absolute confidence in the team that we have at the company to create a safe and effective system. And, you know, the system is designed to be inherently safer than other modes. We have multiple redundancies in place. It's operating autonomously in an enclosed tube. So it's not susceptible to weather, to accidents from, you know, at-grade crossings or a cow on the track. It's not susceptible to human error or power outages. So from my perspective, this is ultimately a safer system than existing modes.
True, but sometimes we don't know what we don't know. That's Sara Lukian, who was one of the first two passengers on a Virgin Hyperloop test ride in the desert north of Las Vegas, Nevada. Thank you for sharing your experience with us. Appreciate it.
Thank you so much for having me.
It wasn't a surprise that big cities were strongholds for Democrats this election. Joe Biden won all of the 20 largest cities in the United States. And while that may seem like a good thing, Derek Thompson writes that Democrats' reliance on the biggest cities to deliver votes is creating problems for the party. Derek is a staff writer at The Atlantic and has a new piece out on this tomorrow called Why Big City Dominance is a Problem for Democrats. He joins us now from Washington, as he does each Monday. Derek, welcome back.
Great to be here. Thank you.
Yes. So can you tell us more about how important cities and densities have really become for Democrats from an electoral standpoint?
Democrats win cities, period. They just win big cities, they win the biggest cities, and they win the suburbs of the biggest cities. That is their coalition. It is a handshake between density, that is the largest downtown areas, and diplomas, the highest educated suburbs of those metros. If you go online and you type into the search bar largest U.S. cities by population, and you scroll down the list, New York City, Los Angeles, Chicago, Houston, Phoenix, you have to scroll all the way to number 25, Oklahoma City, before you get to a metro that Joe Biden didn't win in November. Democrats are just without question the party of the city today, and that's often reflected as a wonderful thing about their future because cities and metros are growing. But I really think it's not necessarily a good thing. It's creating a lot of subtle problems in the party.
Well, more specifically, you write that Democrats' metro coalition is a nightmare for winning national elections, which has to do with the Electoral College and the Senate. Lay out some numbers for us that show us why that's true.
Sure. Well, we hear about Democrats' problems in Electoral College all the time. I don't have to go into that. The real problem, honestly, is the Senate. The Senate, as everybody knows, privileges smaller states. That's just how it was designed. And it is a fact. It's a quirk of modernity that most of the small states today have rural populations with lots of white people without a college degree. And that's the sweet spot for the Republican Party. The GOP currently holds both Senate seats in Alaska, Arkansas, Idaho, Iowa, Kansas, Kentucky, Louisiana, Mississippi, Nebraska, South Dakota, and Wyoming. Those 11 states have 22 senators who collectively represent fewer people than the population of California. So that's a Democrats' problem right there in a nutshell. Yes, Democrats can win the Senate. They have won the Senate, but it requires them to win big in multiple elections in a row. Just look to 2 years ago in the 2018 midterms, Democrats lost the national popular vote in the Senate contest. They won the national popular vote by 18 million, but they lost two net Senate seats to the Republicans. It's just a terrible, terrible map for Democrats to win in the Senate going forward.
Well, you also point to progressives living in the wealthiest cities from San Francisco to New York City who have created a philosophy that does not go over well in other parts of the country. You actually call it Instagram socialism. Can you explain that?
Yeah, I'm going to get in trouble for this one. But here's what I'm saying. There's no question that young college-educated people in America's richest cities are really progressive. I have before called them effectively a third party in America to the left of the Democratic Party. They're also extremely online. And there is something about the dynamics of online interaction that tends to push conversations toward their extreme. And this has created, I think, an urban political movement in this country that is just very far to the left of the average American. Americans love ideas like universal health care, if you poll them. But overall, they aren't that fond of socialism. And so a problem for the Democratic Party is that their young base in cities, extremely educated, extremely online, this movement of what I call Instagram socialism does have a way of branding popular ideas like universal health care with unpopular ideas like socialism. And we have to get to a point, Democrats have to get to a point where they are thinking more about the marginal voter for their party and not just about the base.
Well, you give California as an example of this vast canyon between liberal progressives and cities and everywhere else. The LA Times actually reported a lot of what you're saying here on that divide and how it shows up in voting patterns on a number of ballot measures like rent control and criminal justice. But what does California tell us about the viability of progressivism right now nationwide?
It tells us that cities are far to the left of the regions around them. In the last 10 years, Los Angeles and the Bay Area have moved far to the left of the rest of California. The Los Angeles Times published an analysis of California ballot measures that found that LA and the Bay Area of San Francisco were 30 points to the left of other Californians on issues like affirmative action and allowing parolees to vote. Now, a 30-point gap is a massive gap. That's like the difference between the state of Massachusetts in the presidential election and a purple state like Pennsylvania. So from a political perspective, it's just a straightforward fact that Los Angeles and the Bay Area are beginning to look like leftist havens in an otherwise moderate state. And that is a microcosm of, I think, what we're seeing nationwide, is that metros are growing in population, but their downtown areas, in particular their young population within those downtown areas, has just moved significantly to the left of the average American, and it's creating a really difficult tension within a Democratic Party that's a riotous coalition between AOC-type voters who represent New York City and people in the suburbs of Georgia and Arizona.
Derek Thompson, a staff writer at The Atlantic, as always, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Tanya Mosley.
And I'm Peter O'Dowd. This is Here and Now.